the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. It's Ray. I'm here with Brooke. We're going to have fun today and open it up to all the stuff going on in North Carolina. And we are going to first discuss a favorite book read or movie watched over the summer. So, Brooke, I'm going to kick it over to you. I want to hear some decent books and also a favorite book, but just some films, too, you may have seen this summer that you can recommend, because people are still at home. A lot of folks are still at home. They're bored to death. They probably don't want to watch another movie or read another book, although I do. But, you know, what can we recommend to them on that front?
Ooh, this is great. As soon as we started quarantining, I thought, oh my word, this is going to be the time. Like, this was way back in March. And I thought, this is going to be the time for me to catch up on all of my reading. I'm sad to report that has not been the case, but I have done some reading and some TV watching that I feel like I can recommend to our audience. And so in terms of reading, I've really enjoyed going to J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Our family watches The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit just about every year over Christmas break, but I have yet to read the actual story. And so I started reading The Hobbit. I'm about halfway through right now, so I'm a pretty slow reader. I just, you know, read. I'm a grazer, essentially. Like, I'll come and go, and I'm reading about five or six books at a time. But The Hobbit has been really good. Just an interesting fact about Tolkien, who wrote The Hobbit. He was a philologist. And so he was basically a master of languages and the roots of languages, how they develop over time, creating languages, things like that. So he studied philology. And something about The Hobbit was that he created an entire language called Elvish. And so when you read his words, he's just so masterful and just so articulate. So that's my book recommendation. And before I go on to my movie or TV recommendation, what's your book one?
Oh, that's a great question, because I've read so many books. You know what? I'm gonna shift and pivot a little bit, because this is a book that has been recommended to me by several people, and I don't love it. I've kind of slogged down in it. I'm a little over halfway, and some of you have heard of the author, and you probably heard of the book. It's Michael Brendan Daugherty, My Father Left Me Ireland. I've had several people recommend this book to me. I'm a little over halfway, and I don't love it. I'll probably finish it, but it's a little not depressing, just sort of there's a little bit of malaise to it, and the word I'm looking for is a little bit, not self-absorbed, but maybe I'll lean that way a little bit and call it a little bit self-absorbed. But I hope the storytelling picks up in the book, because I do, you know, the people that have recommended it to me, I respect a lot. The prose is great. I will say that. He's a great writer. The story just hasn't impacted me completely, although I do, I do resonate with parts of it, you know, only for the fact that, you know, my dad, he was with me my whole life. This is about a story of his dad basically abandoning him and going to Ireland. But my dad was an Air Force pilot, so he was gone a lot. So there were, you know, periods of time in my life where my dad was gone for a decent amount of time. And so I'm not comparing my situation to him. But there are a few times when I'm reading through his book and I go, oh, that makes sense, or that resonates a little bit. But yeah, I am looking forward to finishing it, but it hasn't been this huge sort of impactful book that I thought it might be.
Yeah. I've heard good things about that book, but I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is, you know, 3, 4, 5 different people, tons of different people can read the same book and have different takeaways, because, I mean, really, you're looking at it through oftentimes the lens of your own experience, which is great. And it actually helps, I think, provide a better, more well-rounded perspective of a book's, I don't know, classic nature or not. And so that's good to hear. And when it comes to favorite TV shows, well, I put favorite movies on our notes here, but I have not been watching very many movies. I have been watching Lost, or rewatching Lost with my husband. And so Lost has, I think, like 6 seasons, 24 episodes each season. And so we have loved going back through that, because we realized we hadn't watched Lost for probably, I don't know, 8 years or so. And so going back and rewatching it, it feels like we're watching it for the very first time again. And I know it ends on a bad note, and I'm not going to spoil it if you haven't seen it, but the ending is something that Lost fans everywhere really grieved once it, once the series ended. But nonetheless, I still love everything building up to the ending. And so that's been a lot of fun. We try to watch an episode every night, but what about you guys?
Well, we haven't watched much TV lately, but one movie I watched without Kelly, because Kelly, anytime it's a war movie or Trenches, or she asks me, where are the women in this film? She's out. She's like, done. Yeah. You know, this movie had at least, you know, for I would say 95% of the film, there are no women in the film. It's about, it's a book. It's based on the book by Jake Tapper. I don't remember the actual name of the book. But I think it's the same as the film, The Last Outpost. And it's about the army. I don't remember exactly which unit in the Battle of Chemnitz, where 2 Medal of Honor winners come out of that battle. They're surrounded by ISIS or Al-Qaeda fighters. I think technically Al-Qaeda fighters. They're surrounded. This is 2009. They basically get hung out to dry by some of the higher officers at this base, because it's way far out there in the mountains of Afghanistan. They've got kind of forgotten about. They do get their daily or weekly helicopter drop, but they're pretty much left to fend for themselves and deal with the battles and the kind of pacifying the local population. But do read the book or watch the film, because I think it gives you another dimension of the human and American sacrifice and this long entanglement that we've been in Afghanistan, and the heartache behind it, and really the courage of some of those men in the army, what they went through, the PTSD afterward from that battle, 2 Medal of Honor recipients, of course, from that battle. And so their stories are worth learning about, Brooke, and I know you feel the same way. And the film is amazing. The film is actually literally amazing. It's done by, I think, an Army veteran himself as the director. And you've got a couple of the individuals playing themselves in the film. So there's a lot of authenticity. And I think Clint Eastwood's son's in the film, too. I can't remember the name of the other actors. Orlando Bloom's in it, too. I don't know much about him, but I know.
Oh, I like Orlando Bloom.
Yeah, he's one of the big characters in the film. So it's worth watching. And it's a great story. It's a sad story in some respects, but it's a great story, and it shows you just sort of the character of the men that serve in our military. And just a reminder, too, that I think that some of the leadership has let us down in Afghanistan. That doesn't say any indictment against the troops or soldiers or Marines serving over there, but it does say something about some of our leadership, our political leadership, particularly in terms of, you know, not necessarily having the best plan or strategic formation for Afghanistan. I think it's just another, and it's not anti-war by any respects, but I think it does show you the problems that our leadership has entangled us in Afghanistan with no real exit strategy.
Yes. A resounding yes. Now, what's the name of that movie one more time?
The Last Outpost. I think it's The Outpost or Last Outpost. Let me it's just The Outpost, Brooke.
Okay.
It just came out. You can, I don't know if it's $5.99 or $6.99 on Amazon right now. I don't know if you can get it at Redbox. I haven't looked, but it's not on Prime yet or anything, or Netflix. So there's limited ways to watch it. But I do know if you have like a Fire Stick or something, you can watch it that way.
Okay. Well, good to know. I actually want to check that out. It sounds
really good. And I bet James would like it a lot too. I mean, he would, I'm sure he would see it in a way different than even both of us would see it through his experience. And
right. Yeah.
So, the acting is incredible. And This one kind of comment, I was hesitant to bring this up, but it kind of with all this Black Lives Matter stuff going on, there's one of the they cycle through several officers because the lieutenants or the captains die that lead this base. The captains, I think, primarily at this small outpost, Outpost Keating or something is the name of it. And the one of the officers is a black guy. This doesn't say anything about race or anything. I just thought it was interesting with some of the Black Lives Matter stuff. He actually is a coward, it seems like, in the film. And I just thought that was unusual kind of with some of the Black Lives Matter stuff going on. So I think that was coincidental with the way it came out. And I don't know how much of the true story, this is a true story, but I don't know if that, how much that comports, but I just thought from a political perspective, it was very interesting. And obviously there's a black soldier who's one of the big heroes of the battle too. It just, to me, it was just kind of an odd thing that would show up into today's political environment. So to speak.
Right. Any deviation from the accepted and prescribed narrative by, I would say, those in mainstream media and Hollywood is kind of surprising, baffling, but oftentimes welcome. Even if it's stuff that I don't agree with, like, it's okay to push the envelope sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it's important just not to judge people by their race right now. And that almost sounds, you know, that was liberal 30 or 40 years ago, but you know, it's conservative now to say that. You know, people are individuals, Brooke, so we judge people as individuals, and that's the way it should be. You know, and I know we're not all perfect at doing that. We all make mistakes from time to time, but it's just an important, let's look at people individually and make judgments on them and that. And so much of our media and narrative culture doesn't do that anymore, and it's ridiculous. Although, you know, I don't want to, that's not the purpose of why we're having this discussion today, but it's for whatever my comments, whether they're good or bad, go see the film or watch it from your home because you don't have many options to watch it in the theater, I would suspect right now. But it's worth watching. And if you have to pay $4 or $5 for it, it's worth viewing, in my opinion. A great film. It has great ratings from Rotten Tomatoes and other critics. It's an excellent film.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, sounds good. Definitely something that I plan on checking out maybe even this weekend. But hey, let's talk about your blog post that's live as soon as, at least after this is recorded, related to a quote from Judge Janice Rogers Brown. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that, because I know you thought it was particularly relevant to what we're going, one of the conversations we're having right now.
Yeah, I was just reading through this speech. I found it by mistake. I was looking for something else, and she has this speech published at the Philadelphia Society, which is a conservative group. And she says all these great things about American exceptionalism. The speech is from 10 years ago. I think the first time she gave the speech was 2008. She maybe re-edited a few portions, but it's essentially the same speech from 2008 that she gave in 2010. But she talks about the importance of our Constitution society, the American exceptionalism, basically how we're doubting America. We're in this identity crisis right now. And a lot of the stuff, I just think the speech, you just go to the Philadelphia Society and search Janice Rogers Brown. I think it's the only thing that comes up. It's her speech from 2010. One line from it: "The Constitution has sheltered us from those who would destroy freedom, but the fortress is incredibly fragile because it is only as strong as our devotion and allegiance." And really her point is we're doubting so much of America right now, and we're getting pressures from abroad and internally to basically run down America, not believe in American exceptionalism. Don't mean nationalism by that, but how we have created this great experiment and thought process for freedom here and rationality. And it's just worth, I think, going to read the speech. And I think she talks too about education and the collapse of civics and how we're failing in those areas and how it's been a detriment to our society today. And I just saw a lot of parallels to what's going on with some of these mobs and just some of the anger out there, not just at President Trump, which I understand, or other politicians, but anger at America itself and for its past sins, which Janice Rogers Brown, she talks about because she was born to she was a sharecropper's daughter in rural Alabama, Greenville, Alabama, which is not too far from Selma for people who know their civil rights history. So she dealt with a lot of racism. She dealt with a lot of just problems in society, but she rose up. She became a federal judge. She's on the D.C. District or Circuit Court in D.C. Very successful woman, conservative, libertarian, and really had a successful judgeship. She was blocked for 2 years by Democrats, African-American. So just go read a little bit of her story, too, if you don't – most of you remember Janice Rogers Brown, but it's just interesting to hear this speech and with some of the stuff going on today. I thought it was worthwhile, Brooke, and it's on the blog post, too, if you want to search for it that way. Go to our Civitas blog. You can at least find a link to the speech there. So it was really powerful. It really had a profound effect on me. She had some great quotes, too, about our society and what we're dealing with today. I mean, it's a 10-year-old speech, but it's probably more relevant now than even then.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That, I look forward to reading that blog post. And honestly, like I do not know much about her whatsoever. So look forward to getting some illumination on that front. But, another thing that I wanted to talk about, and you and I have, discussed this extensively in the past, but boy, oh boy, is it really just becoming a relevant conversation right now. And that's education here in the state. Many, many parents and 1.5 million North Carolina public school children are finding themselves educationally displaced in a way, just due to the coronavirus and the state's responses to it. And that's creating just a whole nother discussion now, because as of right now, it's looking like between a third and two thirds of North Carolina school children will be virtual only come August, so next month. And then maybe the other two thirds to one third are going to be part time in class and virtual, but is going to be no traditional public school that offers complete full time, to my knowledge, in the state per Governor Cooper's order. And so this is leading to a discussion about parental rights, the role of the state in education, the role of the private sector, and thinking innovatively about schooling. And so one of the issues that it has raised, though, is homeschooling and the way in which homeschooling plays a role in educating students in the state, and where the government needs to, let's say, regulate or police homeschooling. And so recently, North Carolina Policy Watch, if you are a very politically connected conservative in the state, you may have heard of this group. They are far left and very, very aggressively propose bigger government spending on a variety of levels, as well as bigger government intrusion into people's lives. But they have promoted a report from Duke Law that calls for further regulating homeschooling. And so, Ray, I figured we could just spend a few minutes discussing this and sort of trying to wrestle with where the state should be involved in homeschooling, if at all, and where they need to back off.
Yeah, I mean, from your experience, having done homeschooling yourself, but also homeschooled some of your kids, I mean, what do you feel like the role of the state is in this area? Just sort of a quick overview. What is the role of the state? I mean, I'd like to get right. your thought on that. I feel like you have more experience in this area. I make a joke because my wife, Kelly, a few months ago was like, we were with the kids and we're talking about homeschooling. And then she made a comment to them about, you know, the dinosaurs were extinct because she goes, dinosaurs are extinct because they didn't get on the ark. She was telling my older son that. And I was like, what? I was like, did you learn that in homeschooling, Kelly? Because my wife was homeschooled.
Oh, you know what? I remember you saying that now, but I had forgotten that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So I joke because my brother, I struggle with public schools too. I don't have a lot of good things to say about public schools in Mississippi. I know my brother did too. And I remember my mom saying, well, I'll homeschool you. And then my brother made a comment, well, you're not qualified and I'll end up being like the French fry guy at McDonald's if you homeschool me.
Oh.
But I'm a big proponent of homeschooling.
At the time, I
didn't really have an opinion. I thought it was like the weird Pentecostal kids down the street.
Well, there were some of those too, right. To be honest. Okay, but nonetheless, people, it's not a crime to be a weird. It's not a crime to be a weird Pentecostal.
No,
kid.
It's not. No, it's not.
So that's how I'm going to preface what I say about what I believe the role of the state is, and that's that. I believe the role of the state, obviously, when it comes to protecting someone's life and liberty and their pursuit of happiness, you know, they do have a constitutional role. And in the case of children everywhere, regardless of where they attend school, the state's role is to ensure that that child is not being abused. And sadly, we've seen a number of cases come out of the public schools across our state, wherein teachers took advantage, sexual advantage of children.
It's a huge problem. I mean, we talk about the Catholic Church a lot and some other Christian sects or denominations, mm-hmm. but the public schools seem to be more infected than the churches, in my opinion. At least, you know, when you gather some of the media stories, the cover-ups. I know this for a fact. I've got a wife that works in higher ed. It's not just a problem in higher ed, but teachers will transfer around to different schools. They may get fired, an allegation is made, and then they're in some other different school, either in the state or another state. And so, you know, I don't know what the clear reporting rules are, and I don't think there's a database so much where, you know, if they're not convicted, they could just pop up in another school, Brooke.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Oftentimes we don't hear about it and the media doesn't start reporting on it until it's made its way through a number of that perpetrator has made their way through a number of other schools and victimized a number of children. So what I'm getting at though is obviously the state has a role to play when it comes to protecting child safety, and that's irrespective of where a child attends school. But the Duke Law report that I was reading, essentially they rely on that sort of reasoning to call for regulating homeschooling, which I think is absurd because A, there are already laws on the books that address this. They don't need to regulate homeschooling in order to protect a child from abuse. And yes, a teacher in a public school could report abuse, but also a child who's homeschooled is oftentimes going to be around other people and neighbors, which are also people that are able to report abuse, or other family members. Like, so just using that least restrictive means test, to me, that doesn't pass muster, that sort of rationale. And then another thing that the Duke report cited was that North Carolina children, per the Constitution of the state, are entitled to a sound basic education. And once again, I agree with that, but I find it rather, I don't know, humorous, but it's not really funny, is that the state calls for that. And yet, when we look at scores, test scores of children in the public school system, a lot of times it's revealing that a number of public schools are failing to prepare children for the economy. And that was one of the things that the Duke Law report cited was, you know, we need to prepare children to be active citizens in democracy and to contribute to the economy. And I thought, well, if that's the case, I mean, we're losing bigly on this because a lot of our public school students aren't graduating with the proficiencies that they're supposed to. So to put the onus on homeschooling families to either report more to the state or allow the state to adjudicate whether or not they're providing their child with a sound basic education seems a little hypocritical when we're not even upholding those standards in public schools. You can't close down a public school that's failing to do this.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, if the schools were performing so well, I think the argument might be a little bit different, but they're clearly not. Most schools aren't. I'm sure you've experienced the same thing. You've worked with more homeschoolers than I have, but I remember working in several positions where I managed homeschoolers, and they were very intelligent. They weren't weird in any way. They knew a lot. They knew how to write well, and I think that's a skill that is lost on a lot of people today. It's important to know how to write. So in my experiences, I don't see any detriment to homeschooling. They're clearly, in the majority of cases, getting a vastly superior education and skill set to just kind of sticking somebody in a random public school where the learning style is very homogenous, where there is a little bit more bullying than the home, for sure. I mean, the times that I can remember of abuses were much more in school than at home. So I felt like home was a more protective and safe environment. overall. I mean, I went to public schools in Hawaii and Mississippi, which aren't notoriously known for good public schools. And, you know, I think it affected my learning to some degree. And I think it stunted learning in some areas for me. So, you know, in retrospect, if I had an opportunity to homeschool, perhaps I would, you know, even be a little bit smarter than I am today. I don't know, Brooke.
Well, you're pretty darn smart, but I do think that there's something to be said about that bullying aspect of it. And even so, I know a number of people that I personally know homeschool for religious reasons, but there are other reasons that North Carolina families have chosen homeschooling, and bullying is one of them. And so I think that, especially if you're a child that your child just does not conform to social norms the way that society wants them to. And I just think about some of the kids in my school when I was growing up. So I graduated as a homeschooler, but that was only like halfway through ninth grade to 12th grade. I mean, before that, I attended military schools called DOD schools and private school. And I just remember this one boy in my class that was bullied relentlessly, and his dad, I remember his dad committed suicide, and he came back to school and just no one even engaged with him, and just he was just constantly made fun of. And I don't know where he's at today, but my heart breaks for him. And
yes,
a lot of kids go through this, and it's just not right. And so homeschooling provides a refuge for some families. And again, that's not to say that every homeschooling parent is perfect, or that there aren't criminal actions that are taken by parents of all stripes and sending their kids to all sorts of school options. But what I'm saying is to onerously regulate homeschools, or, you know, just use these broad policies that are not targeted and strategic, I think that that is a misstep by the state. And I think it's probably largely politically motivated by teachers' unions and others that really want to hold on to the public school monopoly.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We're facing a time, I think, where there's an element of positive creative destruction in the public schools. Because look, I mean, I think more and more parents are realizing, especially with this COVID-19 stuff going on, there's political reasons. You know, everything's being politicized in society. So now that has extended to public schools. It's been that way for a while, but it's just only getting worse. So it's not just a conservative thing. There are certain people who may be in urban environments who are very secular and liberal. We see this in North Carolina. That's an expanding homeschool base as well. It's not just a conservative Christian thing. This is expanding into other areas, and people just want, you know, we live in this very diverse society. People want to instill their values in their child and in their children, and that's their right. And look, I mean, we're asking, you know, for this homogenous, or we're seeing this homogenous factory model of teaching, and it's not working for most students. So I'm with you 100%. I agree 100%. You know, I remember a bullying situation in a public school that I went to. I won't name the school, but a kid wore certain clothes. He was teased unmercifully. He ended up shooting himself. It was awful. He was in my class. And I remember kids crying at school, but these are the same kids that were like tormenting this kid and stuff. And I just remember just the whole, you know, teenagers aren't nice all the time. And, you know, I remember being a teenager, and I just remember it being very off-putting for me to see some of these kids crying and putting up for a scene for some of the same kids that were torturing this and tormenting this kid. So you're exactly right, Brooke. We got to reform education. Whatever we do, there are so many good public schools in the state and so many good public school teachers, but we do need to expand the option base for parents. It can't be just wealthy families that have the, you know, in Raleigh that can send their kid to St. David's or some other expensive prep school. There should be more options. And I think that's just the American way that we should allow for more money to follow the students instead of just funding the system or just entrenching the bureaucracy. It just doesn't work for most families. And, you know, people, I hope, Brooke, that people will just start thinking deeper about education, and families will start thinking deeper about education. And, you know, I'm starting to do that because I have kids that will be going into school soon. So it's an important issue. And I think it's going to say a lot to sort of the direction of America and which way we turn in the next few generations is how well are we educating our children? And are we doing it in a way that can sustain our republic and build upon our republic instead of tearing it down.
Right. Oh, yeah. That's wholeheartedly agree with that. And so anyways, we want to hear from you guys and see what you think about this, especially if you're a parent of a school age child right now. What are you looking at? What are some of the options you're considering going into this fall? Shoot us an email at radio@nccivitas.org. But really, like Ray mentioned, there's some excellent, excellent public school teachers and administrators. So please don't hear what we're saying as an admonishment to the amazing work that they do every day for our children, because that's not what it is. It's we're talking about the broader ideas of who should have ownership over a child's education and empowering parents to be able to do what they believe is in the best interest of their child. And so that's the heart behind all of this. But we appreciate you guys joining us this week, and we hope that you have a wonderful week. And as always, we welcome feedback. And if you like the show, please feel free to leave us a review on iTunes. That helps us get in front of more eyes. The more reviews we have, the more positive reviews we have, the more eyes we get in front of and get to share these conservative principles with. So you all have a wonderful week.
Thank you.